show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Bouncing ball, Moustakas, fair ball. Sets, throws, Royals win it. Kansas City, you've got a World Series.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. I, of course, am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me, as always, the indubitable Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this fantastic evening?
It is a pretty good evening. I'm all right. I actually have kind of like a night to stop doing things.
Yes. If you couldn't tell from the sporadic recording sessions that we've had, Mike and I have been quite busy lately, both with work. Life and all that kind of stuff. I feel like we're saying that every week now.
Yeah, I mean,
but it's true, you know. If it wasn't true, it wouldn't be. Yeah, so hopefully things will settle down, but you never know. Life throws them curveballs at you, and you know,
and as they say,
yes,
terribly sometimes, like Sal Perez in late September.
Yes, sometimes except you're Mike Moustakas, and sometimes you're Alex Gordon. You know, you never know. So, but before we get to the Royal stuff, we did want to drop a little nugget on you. The Kelly's is having their annual block party coming up here soon in May. Is it May 23rd? Is that right?
It'll be May 24th. I think 24th, it starts. Sorry. Yeah, it's a Sunday, which is what they did last year. I think it starts at 8:30 at night. Live music. It's always a joint effort between Kelly's and McCoy's across the street. It's usually gets really good reviews. A lot of people have a lot of fun. So that's something that's going to be happening. You know, Kelly's is, you know, one of the big players down there in Westport. So, obviously they help us out on this show by, well, making sure we don't lose money. And, so we want to encourage you guys to go down there and, hang out at Kelly's, hang out at the block party, and have some fun.
And if you're worried about it being on a Sunday, the next day is Memorial Day.
Right, so which is why they always do it.
Yes, you shan't have to work and have to worry about getting up early or going into work hungover, because we all know that sucks. You don't have to worry about it. So head on down to Kelly's in Westport, May 24th, block party. You're going to hear about it from us up until then. And I don't know if Mike's going. I will not be able to make it because I will be out of town because we're going to New Orleans for my 30th birthday. Huh? Nice. How about that?
That's yeah. Not bad.
Pretty excited about that, but we'll be going that weekend. So
life begins at 30.
That's what I'm told.
That's when you can start saying, to heck with it, I like this, go away.
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
It's a lot of fun.
Yes, I'm looking forward to the big 3-0. I feel like I've been 30 for a few years now, but if 30 is a mindset, then I'm closer to 40.
I hear you.
But in terms of my biological age, it's not quite there yet. So anyway, enough about me, Mike. Let's talk about some Royals here.
Okay.
They just scored. We're recording this, by the way. This is about 7:30 on a Monday night, so we're right in the middle of the East Coast time zone game against Cleveland, and the Royals just scored to go up 4-2. So hopefully it stays like that or better by the time you hear this. However, some interesting news – not news, interesting happenings from last week.
Yeah, basically since we recorded last.
Yes. Last time we recorded, we touched on some of the issues with, hey, do people like hate the Royals now? What's going on? Everybody's throwing at them. Are they really throwing at them? Is it intentional? Is it just accidental? What's the deal here? And we kind of thought it would hopefully die out and it wouldn't be a big deal. And what do you know? The Royals play the White Sox, which really started it all, because that's what started the whole persecution angle, really, when Lorenzo Cain got hit by Jeff Samardzija on opening day after, Mike Moustakas' home run?
Yep.
So that was kind of the impetus for all the Royals players getting plunked. Should they fight back? Retaliation, blah, 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 fisticuffs, next thing you know. They play the White Sox again. And Chris Sale's on the mound, and all hell breaks loose. Just everybody's going nuts. Yordan Ventura is pitching a great game.
Yeah,
I'm actually at a bar, doing some trivia with my wife and some friends, and I'm watching the game kind of out of the corner of my eye as I can on the TV, and I see, I'm like, man, Yordan Ventura has gone through 6 2/3 innings. He's only given up 2 runs. He's pitching really well. He's got 8 strikeouts. And then he gets the batter to Adam Eaton to grounder right back to him. I'm like, oh, sweet. Yordan Ventura is going to get out of this inning. 7 innings, 2 runs. Great. And it's then like, all of a sudden.
What is he doing?
Yeah. And he
why is he talking to him?
He kind of hesitates, and I'm like, okay, maybe, because I can't really tell because the angle I was at and everything and the angle of the camera. I was like, well, maybe he's just trying to make a good throw. And then next thing you know, Eaton charges him, and then you got Sal Perez and Moustakas come in trying to get Ventura out of the way, and then all the bullpens and the benches clear, and then Lorenzo Cain comes running in, and then all of a sudden Lorenzo Cain and Jeff Samardzija make eye contact like star-crossed lovers from across the room.
Right.
And then they start going at it, and then Lorenzo Cain's being pulled away, and Samardzija comes in with a haymaker, and he whiffs like a bitch. And then and then Volquez comes in with his own haymaker, and he whiffs almost just as bad. And it's like, what is going on? And the whole bar just stopped, and everyone's glued to the TV. The trivia announcer lady even made a comment about it for the next question. But, man, it was nuts. I mean, what was going through your head when that was happening?
I mean, first of all, I was like, I didn't even understand what the heck the deal with Ventura, you know, because he fields a comebacker, thrown great, looked good all game. And then all of a sudden he's saying a very clear thing to Adam Eaton. And I'm like, why is he doing what?
Yes. Someone...
And then it comes out and I'm like, why is he? God dang it. You know, because
yep.
Through all of this, you know, in Anaheim, you know, Ventura had the little thing with Mike Trout. Which was kind of like, okay, well, that was stupid, but nobody was really saying anything about it yet. And then you get the Brett Lowry stuff against the A's, you know, where he's the guy who, you know, Ventura's him clearly intentionally and, you know, starts walking towards him as Lowry's kind of trying to take first. And so, you know, then you start hearing the rumblings of, okay, well, what's up with Ventura? Why is he doing this? And so then when this is a third straight start where this happens, I'm like, okay, like the Anaheim stuff, I'm like, okay, that was dumb, but maybe there's something else there. With Oakland, it's very clear that Lowry was reckless in sliding into second. And, you know, that's one of those spots where, like, the Royals were going to retaliate. There was no way they weren't. It was perfect spot for Ventura. He'd just given up the 5th run. They were already losing. He's up there. He's the hardest throwing starter, you know, perfect storm. So on one hand, it's like, okay, they don't need to retaliate, but they were going to, and that's probably the guy that would have been retaliating. So, you know, combining that with him walking towards Eaton, then it's like, okay, what are you doing? Seriously, like, I can end 3 of these in a row.
Yeah, exactly.
Except it did come out later that, okay, well, Eaton's, like, jawing at him right out of the box.
Yeah.
And so
apparently Eaton thought he was quick pitched.
Yeah.
By Yordan Ventura. Which goes back to another I mean, this kind of we talked about with retaliation last episode, the we can kind of expand that to these unwritten rules of baseball, quote unquote, which for unwritten rules, they're awfully different interpretations across the league on what constitutes abiding by said rules. It's pretty ridiculous. And
like they have enough trouble like interpreting the written rules. So,
right. I mean, exactly.
When you have 30 teams, you have probably 30 different sets of unwritten rules.
It's just so dumb. And then, so assuming that, just to bring to a separate point, if Adam Eaton is upset about Yordano Ventura doing a quick pitch on him, like the idea that there's this decorum in baseball and competitive sports, like obviously you don't go out and try and injure somebody, which we'll get to in a second here as part of this whole conversation. But, you know, when it comes to just getting an advantage, something you deem as cheap or whatever, like I've always thought that players getting pissed about a quick pitch was dumb, because I'd be out there, you know, damn right I'm going to try and quick pitch you. You're a professional. You're in the batter's box. Be ready.
Yeah,
you
it's your job to be ready.
I'm allowed to pitch to you, so I'm gonna pitch. Matter of fact, I would probably be hated so much because I would try and kind of mix up my patterns and stuff to keep them off edge. It's an advantage that's completely within the bounds of the rule book. So why the hell not? So that bothers me, first of all, that he would even say something. But then if he's going to say something because he's upset, and then Ventura's reaction, and it's like you said, I can defend him against Mike Trout, and I did, saying, you know, I'd like the fire, I like the attitude, if you will, not backing down. I think as a starting pitcher, especially a young one, you need that. And I think that's why he was so successful last October and in the World Series and everything. But at the same time, when it's a repeated incident like this, you kind of have to take a step back for a second and be like, okay, you know, let's find a better way to channel this, because you don't want to lose it, because it's an important part of who he is. But he's just, you can't make boneheaded moves like he's doing, you know, having that shit eating grin when you're going at Lori after you hit him, and, you know, talking back, making a very clear, very
you didn't need for Jeremy Guthrie's interpretation.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was getting at, to get when he says that. But you know, you looked at last year's team, and people talk about, you know, oh, well, they're missing the veteran leaderships of James Shields and all that. And maybe this kind of, some of these events have actually kind of maybe put a little bit more stock into that. But beyond veteran leadership, one of the interesting things about James Shields was he was one of the most fiery, most competitive guys out there. But what made him so successful, I think, or at least part of it, besides his obvious natural skill set, is the fact that he could channel that stuff so well. He'd give up a big home run or a big hit, and he'd step off the mound, and he'd turn away, and he'd put his glove over his mouth, and he'd yell and curse into it, and then take a deep breath and refocus. And that's why he was able to just, you know, you could never, very rarely did you just get after James Shields for 8 runs or something like that. You know, it was always, he was able to settle down and kind of regain his composure. And, you know, if nothing else, it was kind of leading by example. I mean, I think Yordano Ventura could benefit from kind of learning along those similar lines, to taking a step back. And, you know, granted, some of these times he's been confronted with some of these things, but, you know, take a step back, reassess, channel it, and just get after him on the pitching mound instead of, you know, trying to provoke fighting or whatever the hell he's trying to do out there.
Yeah, and when it all, you know, finishes up, he's now got a 7-game suspension.
Yeah,
you know, that's not helpful. Which, you know, I don't know. I mean, he had his role in the White Sox stuff, but he only got fined for hitting Lori, and I think the incidents all in a row are really what ended up with that 7-game stretch. Just because, you know, they have to say something. They have to, you know, get some kind of a message sent to him so that he stops doing this stuff. And, you know, just a way to say I'm gonna hurt the team, because now he's going to miss a start, or it's going to, you know, cause somebody to, you know, make a spot start. And so that's a problem. I don't know if it's necessarily veteran leadership. I mean, you have guys like Vargas and Guthrie and Volquez, and those guys are all veteran starting pitchers, and the team as a whole is older than they're based on, you know, who they brought in, and, you know, just players being older, 1 year, you know, one more year league. So I'm not super concerned about, you know, the veteran leadership. I think it's just a matter of, you know, the Royals ended up at a point where, being hit. And most of those I don't believe were intentional. I don't think, maybe two of them were intentional, Kane and I don't even know what the other one would be. But, just things where the Royals end up having to respond in some ways. They end up, Samardzija hits Kane, so Duffy throws behind Adam LaRoche. Or, Brett Lowry takes out Escobar, so they hit Lowry. And, it seems everything's done. And then Kazmir comes out and hits Kane the next day. And then you get the thing where Herrera throws behind Lowry later in that game. Things just kind of keep going. And then the White Sox, you get the same kind of deal where, Ventura was saying something, but it was in response to Eaton. And then you get to where Jeff Samardzija is like yelling at them between innings. And he's like the guy right in the middle of it, restarting things once it starts to kind of calm down. So the Royals, the easy thing for a lot of people to say are like, okay, well, if you're in a fight every other series, maybe it's you. But at the same time, it's like, they're really just responding in a lot of ways. Now, they can respond better, of course, and they should, but it's not like they're out there throwing at guys first and then talking smack and doing all that. It's they're just reacting to, how the situation is. And so now they kind of have a little bit of a black mark against them. So someone called them the bad boys of baseball, which is kind of cheesy. I mean, they're not. I think most of them are good guys. It's just they've gotten in their scrapes.
And what's interesting is if you want to call them the bad boys of baseball or whatever, then I'm totally okay with that. And there's a couple reasons. First of all, they remind me of, and someone brought up a similar example on the radio. I can't remember who it was when I heard it, but they remind me of like if you're playing playing pickup basketball or something, you see a bunch of little kids and they look, kind of scrappy or whatever. And you're like, whatever, you think your skill is way better than them, whatever the case may be. This is not me talking because I suck at basketball, but I'm just saying in general, if someone were to be good at basketball and that's what they saw, but then you start playing them and they're, the term I think you might say is try hard. Possibly, but they're out there, they're moving around, they got their hands in your face, they're deflecting balls and everything, and eventually that gets under your skin, it gets in your head, and then you start making unforced errors and makes mistakes that you normally wouldn't make because they're starting to kind of get under your skin and piss you off, and they're playing with so much energy and everything, and it's like, come on, man, like, are you serious? That's what I think all the other teams are feeling right now, where they're just, they kind of look out and they say, man, these guys are playing with so much energy. They're having so much fun. And don't they realize this is a business? This is a marathon, not a sprint. They're not playing the game like we're playing the game. So they're the ones that are doing it wrong, And it's like, up until they start, you start talking about throwing balls at people and stuff, everything else has been, within the rules. It's just not something that most Major League Baseball players define as good taste. Which is dumb because it's completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
But the second part of that is if people in media and possibly other teams are calling the Royals the quote unquote bad boys of baseball or whatever the case may be, then I'm totally fine with that because that means they're in their heads.
Yeah.
And they're getting really close to the point. I heard Kevin Kietzman make this similar point on the radio the other day. They're getting close to the point to where the game is over before they even step on the field. You look at teams like the Oakland A's of the 70s, nobody liked those guys. They didn't even like each other. And I mean, they were fighting in the clubhouse and they won three straight World Series. You had, the Detroit Pistons of the 80s, everybody hated them. They played with real big intensity and they did have some dirty players, but all the same, that's the way it was, and they won two straight championships. And, there's – because a lot of times they get inside teams' heads, and the game's over before they even get out there. And the example that I heard Kietzman brought up that I hadn't really thought of that way, but was Brett Lowry had said that he had talked to Albert Pujols, who said – Pujols said that the Royals were a Bush League team. So first of all – it's great that there are two players playing a baseball game in a different state, different stadium, two different teams, nothing to do with the Royals. In game, Brett Laurie gets on base, and regardless of what was actually said, they were talking about the Royals in their own game, talking about a different team. Like, that is a lot. That means you're in their heads. And that was a very good point that I heard. And then to think Pujols called Ned Yost to say, no, that quote was inaccurate. I didn't really say that. And whether he did or not is not the point, because he called because he was worried. He didn't want to be the guy to be
the bulletin board material.
Exactly. He didn't want to be the bulletin board material. He didn't want to be the guy that they were coming after. He didn't want to be the focal point of any Royals ire, because now that's a threat to be. And I'm not talking about from the Royals trying to hit somebody threat, but I am talking about the idea that, you know, the Royals can use that and focus their energies towards some sort of event like that, to where they can channel it and, you know, play better, especially against that particular team. And that's a legitimate threat that players have to worry about now. And that's encouraging to me, even if it comes with some of the baggage, little negative side effects of oh, everyone hates the Royals now. I mean, you have any similar feelings on this? Yeah, exactly.
It's like if the Royals were, you know, 8-10, it probably wouldn't be getting as much play, but because they're playing well, they're coming off of the AL championship, and now they're doing all the same stuff. Well, now it's a different thing, because it's not really fun in games, because every team's going to have to play them now. I remember back in fan reactions when the Royals were playing the Orioles in the ALCS, and the Royals were, you know, hyped up on every play. And it's like, well, why do they have to celebrate every play? Well, because they want to celebrate every play, you know. And then, but the frustrating thing would have to be that if you weren't ahead after six, it was done. You know, the Royals were going to go to Herrera, Davis, and Holland, and it was done. And that's got to be frustrating as a fan base. It's probably got to be frustrating as a team. And it's like you said, you know, you're already knowing what you're in for before the game starts. It's like, okay, they're going to make all the plays on defense, and if you're not getting through them, you know, before the sixth inning, you're probably not going to get them. And so that's pretty tough. That's a lot of pressure, and it can really make teams react poorly. If they're more concerned about what the Royals are doing, they're not as concerned about what they're doing themselves. So I can definitely see that. I mean, I have an example from, you know, just coaching Little League. Two weekends ago, we had a tournament, and we were playing in the final game against this team that had won like 10-2 and 14-2. And so we're playing, and we had won our one game like 3-1. You know, we're a bunch of like 13-year-old kids. They're like 14-year-old monsters. And it looked like an easy one for the other team. And we come out, and the first two innings, we put up 7 runs, and we don't give up in it. Like, we give up 1 hit, no runs. So right away, we just popped them in the mouth. They didn't even know, like, how to react. And, you know, it's very much a Royals kind of way of doing things. It's like, okay, all of a sudden, boom, the Royals are running the bases like crazy, making plays on defense, and you're still trying to kind of get into the game. And so, you know, when you combine that with some attitude, I can see why teams would be rubbed the wrong way. Now, that doesn't mean the Royals need to be in fights every week or every other series, but, you know, I think some of it is a reaction to how the Royals were down the stretch last year, and the idea that there is a way to play the game, and the Royals are, too excited, too flamboyant, too demonstrative in what they're doing as they play it. And so a lot of teams are going to be like, hey, we're not going to let them get that over on us. And, you know, I think that's why, you know, they're throwing inside more, challenging guys inside, and you get hit sometimes. You know, they've been hit a lot, but I don't think most of them are intentional.
No.
But in the cases of, like, you know, Mike Moustakas hits a homer, well, there's Lorenzo Cain getting hit. That's pretty clear. You know, the A's feel like things aren't done after Saturday, after Saturday. And so Lorenzo Cain gets hit by a guy who threw like 8 balls out of the strike zone all day. So, you know, it doesn't look very it doesn't look legit to say that one just got away from him.
It was quite literally the furthest ball outside of the strike zone that he's thrown in 3 years. You're talking about Scott Kazmir, right?
Scott Kazmir, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, somebody went back and checked the pitch graph or whatever it's called, and showed every single, I think it was a two-seamer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, every single one of them that he's thrown since 2011, I believe, is how far back. Maybe it was 2012, but 2012, every one. And there was one outlier that was clearly the furthest, and it was the one that hit Lorenzo Cain. That evidence is there. You can make up your own mind. We're not here to make up your mind for you, but we're going to put that out there, and you can do whatever you want with it.
Unfortunately, the fallout is you have some suspensions to get through.
Be rough.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Ventura can really get his appeal down just because there's been so much stuff. Herrera.
I would think Ventura has a shot of getting a couple games knocked off simply because he didn't actually throw any punches.
Yeah.
He was just jawing out there. But Herrera, I don't think, has much of a chance. Edinson Volquez has already dropped his appeal.
Yeah, he's just going to
take it.
Today. Yep.
So, and
which maybe that tips off what they feel about the others. They just want to get his out of the way now, so the others, you know, the rest aren't a problem.
I'm kind of wondering if that's what they're doing, saying appeal the suspensions, and then just maybe kind of one by one drop off, so we can at least stagger all of them.
Right.
I don't wonder if maybe
a 20-man roster.
Yeah, I'm thinking that might be, you know, not only smart but advisable if you're the Royals.
And Herrera's kind of coincide with Greg Holland probably coming back from the DL pretty soon. So, you know, obviously they're going to appeal those. I didn't see him do anything in the White Sox game, but he got two games for that too. So I don't know. He's got two separate appeals that he's waiting on, which.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's going to work, but.
And Herrera, you know, it's weird, like with Herrera's situation, throwing behind somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is another scenario where had he just done that, I think, you know, I would have been like, well, that's dumb, but I at least understand why he did it, even if I don't agree with it. Now, this whole business of him pointing to his head and possibly alluding to the fact that he was aiming for his head and/or will try and hit his head next time.
Yeah,
that was a little much, and I don't agree with that in really any facet. So, but you know, then it goes back to these kind of unwritten rules, you know, where it's like, okay, here's where my logic fails me. I try and pride myself on having logical thoughts despite what I often say on this show. But so let's say this, right? The unwritten rules, more or less, will say to you, if you're going to try and retaliate, go ahead, but make sure you hit someone
right
in between the shoulders and the waist. Right?
It's
least likely to give them a serious injury. Because we want, while you're intentionally trying to injure someone, we want to make sure you're not intentionally injuring someone, is basically the logic that's being used there. So it's really funny because that, by the quote unquote unwritten rules, that is okay. But at the same time, if some of the excuses that were made to try and defend pitchers who have hit the Royals was, oh, you know, like one of the Twins pitchers, you know, oh, this guy's he's a young guy. He hasn't pitched very much. And that one just got away from him.
Yeah. Rios.
Yeah. And it hit somebody. It's like, well, you know, that's okay. That's what people are trying to use to explain away hitting someone. And for what it's worth, that scenario, I agree. I think that the kid was a Rule 5 guy. He
came in bases loaded.
Yeah, I mean, they basically sent him out there to be the sacrificial lamb, more or less.
And he didn't respond well.
Yeah, one got away from him. That does, in fact, happen. I do believe that it does happen. However, if by using that logic to defend a pitcher in that scenario, then you're admitting to the fact that, yes, in fact, some pitches don't go, believe it or not, exactly where a pitcher wants them to.
Yeah.
So then you're saying by these unwritten rules, you're allowed to throw from this certain area at someone, however fast you may or may not throw as a pitcher. So then, like, what happens if that one that you're intentionally trying to throw at someone, what if that one gets away from you and it gets away from you high and it hits them in the head? You know, then it's like, well, he was intentionally trying to hit him in the head and injure him and all this kind of stuff. And it's just like, it just goes back to, let's back up and think about how stupid all this crap really is.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, you see where I'm coming from on this?
Yeah. I mean, and now you've got, you know, a quarter of the team that's got suspensions they have to deal with or appeal down or whatever. You've got, you know, reputations for the next time. You've got... you know, teams that are probably going to try to get at Ventura and try to tick him off and try to do little things. You know, maybe a batter tries, you know, steps in, steps out at last second, just tries to mess with him, you know, just so that he's thinking more about what the guy's doing than what his next pitch needs to be. And, you know, if that's something that works, then the other team wins in those kind of encounters. You know, either Ventura gets off his game or he does something stupid again, or... you know, you're just messing with them. So, you know, you've got the Royals not really thinking about playing baseball. They're playing, you know, whatever cat and mouse stuff they have to do that's not really baseball. So it is pretty silly how, you know, it just escalates. It's just at this stage, you've got, you know, the A's stuff and then the White Sox stuff right after. I mean, that looks like one big pattern, and it looks like, okay, well, now they're in fights. And so, like, yeah. Trevor Bauer today at the Indians game, who's kind of a weird guy, was wearing boxing gloves in the dugout, which, you know, I don't think he intended to use them or intended to have reason to use them, but it's, you know, one of those nods.
He's making, like, a joke about how,
yeah, it's like, hey, you know, who knows?
Right now, for those that watch Jim Rome, you'll catch this reference, but right now the Royals are – not watch Jim Rome. Hear, listen to Jim Rome's radio show. The Royals are likes to fight guy. You know, the guy you go out to the bar with your buddy and the dude cannot just cannot help himself. He's going to accidentally bump into somebody completely innocent, and he's going to run his mouth because that's just the kind of guy that he is. You know, I'm not saying that's what the Royals are, but that's the perception of the Royals now by people like Trevor Bauer and the Indians and whatnot. That's why they're going to, you know, and it's almost an antagonistic type of thing where they're going to try and get the Royals to do that to get them out of their game, which brings me to my biggest concern with all this, which isn't even as much about the suspensions or any of that stuff. It's just about the energy level required not to play the way the Royals do, because I think they can sustain that through the whole season, but the energy level required to just constantly be mired in all this drama and deal with suspensions inside and outside of the game and everything, all that stuff coming together, it takes a toll on you. And, you know, it's hard enough to get through 162 games as it is without adding all that extra crap to it. So that has been my biggest concern. Even before last weekend when all the stuff blew up with the White Sox, it was still, you know, even if they're just going to be the bad boys, you know, and kind of cause some little drama, a little back talk, you know, a little smack talk here and there, but nothing resulting in suspensions, even if they were going to do that, that still takes a lot of energy. It's to get that worked up all the time, excuse me, and to have the kind of that roller coaster ride.
And to stay on guard and to just be ready to go. It's
like last year's roller coaster, but of a different kind.
Yeah.
It's not wins or losses. It's off the field stuff. And it just, that's my concern. I don't want the Royals to get burnt out on being, dealing with this weird persona that, you know, they may or may not have earned, and it causes them to go on a big losing skid at some point.
Yep. I mean, I want to see a few really boring series where they just go and play baseball and none of this stuff comes up, and maybe the reputation can fade out a little bit, and you know, the Royals just aren't that kind of, you don't have that talking point anymore, because it is a distraction, I think, to some extent. I mean, it's something that, you know, as fans, that's been a lot of the last week of discussion, is like, well, okay, well, here's this and how is it being portrayed? And so, you know, it doesn't seem like it's been portrayed fairly, a lot of, you know, just because it's easy to paint the Royals in that kind of image. And in some ways you kind of embrace it a little bit because it can be kind of a rallying thing. And I think, you know, they're a close team. They were a close team last year and you saw that. But I mean, it's also time for guys like, you know, Eric Hosmer and Sal Perez and Mike Moustakas to, you know, really be like, okay, let's get back to playing baseball. And, you know, Hosmer's kind of said the right things to that effect, through all of this. So, I mean, hopefully that kind of takes.
Sorry to interrupt, but that's been one of the funniest things to me through this whole thing, is knowing what we know about Hosmer and Moustakas,
right,
off the field, and as they've come up through the system,
yeah,
my thought has actually been, man, I wish the Royals would act more like Hosmer and Moustakas. Like that's kind of, I'd never thought I would say that.
Right.
Just knowing what we all know about how competitive and kind of, you know, some would say arrogant. And yeah, they're definitely, they've got some dude bro in them, but they have both handled all of this extremely well.
Yeah.
And they're kind of the leaders in the terms of the initial stuff that pissed everybody off, the excitement Hosmer's at. Whenever he gets a big play or hits a double or something, you know, he's out there on second base looking at the dugout, screaming and flexing or whatever. And Moustakas does the same thing. And, you know, so they, in a lot of ways, have kind of led that charge. So it's interesting to see them handle it with the most class, if you will. So it's, that's been kind of funny for me to see how that's evolved.
Yeah. It's, I wouldn't have expected it 3 years ago.
No, definitely
to be
not
that way. But, you know, I guess
I'll take it.
Hosmer's kind of the face of the franchise kind of guy right now. And Moustakas has a lot of attention because he's doing all of his, you know, this kind of renewal of success, I guess.
He's playing really well.
So, you know, I guess that's kind of weird, but.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, it's interesting also that I think with Kane now, I think two things have kind of evolved from his coming out party of last October, where, you know, you ALCS MVP. Well, now everybody knows who he is. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know if I'd say he's necessarily a target, but, you know, people are going to be focusing on him because he's a big part of the team now and everybody knows it. And then it also gave him a lot of confidence. I think that's showing.
Yeah.
You know, in a good way, but also kind of the flip side of that is similar to Ventura. You know, he's not backing down from anybody. And, you know, if I was Kane, I wouldn't either, because the dude's a freak. But
yeah.
Athletically speaking.
Well, it's like when he got hit by Samardzija on opening day, like the look he gave him was like, oh, man,
that thing is chilling.
Don't mess with him. Like, he's a happy dude, but oh, boy. Yeah, don't cross him.
Yeah,
is what it looks like.
And something else we haven't really touched on yet is interesting that we've kind of talked about the Royals angle of it, but the flip side is we've talked about how other teams may view the Royals, but it's interesting from a media perspective, and even to a lesser extent from a Major League Baseball perspective, how other teams have gotten off either scot-free, mm-hmm, or with much less severe punishment based on how they've reacted. Because, see, this goes back to these just asinine unwritten rules again. But if we go back to the big fight last Thursday, talk about Yordano Ventura, Adam Eaton, that scenario, people went nuts on Ventura. And yeah, he kind of had a track record, a couple other incidents, but people went nuts on Ventura for doing what he did, right?
Yeah.
But, and then people went nuts on Volquez he threw a punch. He threw a big punch that if it would have connected, would have done some damage, but he whiffed like a, anyway.
Yeah.
but you know, the first truly physical, you know, besides just the requisite, you know, up in your face kind of faux shoving thing.
The scrum.
Yeah. The biggest thing was Zamarja running out of the dugout, coming out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And trying to
get the Kane for whatever reason.
For whatever reason, even though he was the one that started everything by plunking Kane way back when.
Yeah.
So Zamarja could, if you really wanted to break it down, kind of be responsible for the whole thing from the start of it, really. And then he comes in and he tries to do that, and he hardly anybody's talking about Zamarja. He's shown himself to be just as much of a hothead as Ventura has.
Yeah.
And he's not shown any more self-control. But because there's this guise of retaliation and protecting his teammates and blah, 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 and all this other bull crap, somehow Zamarja gets off kind of scot-free. And then we haven't talked about this source that has said, have we got any confirmation on this, that Chris Sale went over to the Royals dugout to try and fight Yordano Ventura?
Yeah.
Have we got any confirmation on this? That was something that Nate Buchady tweeted.
Nate Buchady had that first, and it ended up Chicago Reporter had it too. So it happened. He was trying to get into the clubhouse. They didn't open the door wisely.
Yeah. And the next day, you know, you want to talk SportsCenter or PTI or whatever else.
Yep.
The talk was all Royals and Ventura.
All you're seeing is Ventura saying what he said blurred out.
Yeah.
That's all you see.
You know, to their credit, one guy on it was either MLB or Baseball
Tonight. Harold Reynolds.
Yeah. He actually said he showed the video from the other side that showed Eaton was the one that started John first.
Yeah.
So he was trying to be objective as much as he could.
Yeah.
But, you know, where's all this talk about Zamarja, who's been just as big of a problem as any Royals player has?
Been involved in two incidents, and Ventura's been in three. So where are the calls for Zamarja to be sat down and told how it is and all of that?
Yeah, I mean, and where's the, you know, if this was a year ago and the Royals weren't involved, people would be talking all kinds of crap on Brett Laurie because people love to talk crap on Brett Laurie. When did he all of a sudden become this guy that MLB players and media rally around as some sort of scion of noble baseball? The dude's a D-bag. He's a dirty player. And he's been plays out of control league-wise. He's 25. He's on his third team. He's been traded twice because nobody wants to deal with his crap. And yet all this, it's somehow he gets to be this bastion of light in the darkness brought upon by the Royals. You know, it doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't. And Lowry is first class, you know what, from like on and off record accounts. I mean, it's funny. Like, I think it was in the chat or maybe it was just another column or something, but Andy McCullough said something about he talked to scouts who wouldn't really let him go on record, but he said, boy, they can say some things. It's like, yeah, I have an idea what things they're saying, because I mean it's not exactly a secret that Lowry does not play well with others, and for him to kind of come out of this unscathed, like, oh, he gets credit for going to first base without incident, okay, well, good for him, but he's also yelling at the fans and he beats up a water cooler and had the slide that started it all anyway, which, you know, if he'd have slid like a normal person, he'd have been safe. And instead he, you know, went spikes up into a player. So I don't think he should get a benefit of the doubt, but he has for some reason.
Yeah, because like his foot was like a foot off the ground, spikes up. And if his foot was that high off the ground, but he turned it down, you know, so he's more hitting kind of with the shin to try and break up the play, I wouldn't have had a problem with it. He probably wouldn't have injured Escobar, and, you know, it wouldn't have been a big thing. But instead, he chose to slide like that. And while I don't ever think that he intended to injure Escobar, he certainly intended to run into him, to hit him. And that's what happened. And he's got to deal with the consequences. But somehow, no one's really talking about that. You know, all they're talking about is the Royals. And it's interesting because I was kind of thinking back. Do you remember when the Rays first started to kind of be good? And then something similar happened between like the Rays and the Red Sox in spring training or something. Some dirty slide, and then they got in this huge scrum. People were like, "Oh, are the Rays and the Red Sox the new rivalry in the AL East type of thing?" So I mean, this is kind of what reminds me of that scenario where it's just kind of the new kids on the block, if you will, with AL defending AL champions. They gotta. You know, everybody's coming after him. They got to have a rival with somebody. It's like,
Yeah, the example I've heard is like big brother, little brother, where little brother starts to catch up and maybe, is playing even in a basketball game. So big brother is going to be a little more physical to mess with them or something or bully him or whatever. Yep. It kind of seems like that's some of what happens. And I think, you know, the Rays and other teams coming up have run into that same kind of thing. And, you know, the Royals, I guess they're reacting in similar ways where they're not really taking it. They're just kind of, you know, sticking together as teammates and generally playing good baseball. So, I mean, in the end, the scoreboard's the big winner, regardless of who wins this fight or this beanball war or whatever. And, you know, they're 12-6 and they have a lead tonight. So, I guess that's what counts. It's just, you know, they can't keep getting into these kind of scrapes and have that continue because either someone's going to get hurt, someone's going to get completely thrown off, or, you know, they're going to have these suspensions that pile up. And you can't keep having that happen.
No. And, I mean, through it all, the most encouraging thing is that they're still winning ball games. So that the the night of the big scuffle against the White Sox, they came. It was a tie ball game, and they came back and won it late. You know, so they didn't let it get to them too much. Now they came back and they lost the next two games, but I'm not going to put too much stock into that because it was awful weather. They actually had to postpone one of the games, and they played the final inning or two the next day, and then basically had kind of a mini doubleheader, and it was weird circumstances.
There were basically two bad innings on Sunday, and that was it.
Yeah, so, you know, whatever. Even the best teams lose two in a row once or twice.
And the White Sox are a team that they'll probably be .500 or better, and a lot of people thought they'd be a wild card or a division contender. So it's like, you know, they did a lot to improve this offseason. They're not, you know, it's not like the Twins. I mean, I can see a little bit of disappointment if you lose two out of three to the Twins, and the Royals have already done that, and they're still 12-6. So
and now that they've lost two in a row, you know, the Royals are winning 6-2 in the bottom of the eighth. So hopefully that'll hold on, and they'll win that game, and then they can kind of be done with this talk, because there's been a little bit of a mini Royals freak out over the two losses in a row.
But this fan base is great at those freak outs. I mean,
we've got it down to a science.
Oh yeah. I mean, to be fair, I mean, they are 5-6 in their last 11 games, and their scoring has dropped significantly to where, you know, they're just getting over 3 runs a game in that 11 game stretch. But, you know, at the same time, it's like a couple of those games are winnable. They haven't really been beat up too much in any of them. It's just a matter of they're like one hit away, or they haven't hit home runs at the rate that they did to start the year, but nobody thought that was going to continue. So it's just a matter of like getting the starting pitching to kind of settle down. Volquez has been really good, but Ventura has been iffy. Duffy is kind of building back from a rough start, and Vargas and Guthrie haven't been very good. Bullpen's been nails, but you kind of got to think the bullpen's going to regress some. The starters will probably regress towards improvement, and, you know, just kind of see what the hitters do. So, the 7-0 start, that's a good start. And if they're 13-6 at the end of the night, that's, you know, even better, especially in this stretch where they're playing Cleveland and Detroit, I think, are the next 13 games. I think they alternate series with them. So that's it's obviously important when those are the two other main contenders in the Central. So they've got to come out and really perform here. And they can't get involved in those kinds of things because it's just like, you know, like we said, if it's something that's going to be a distraction or take them out of the game, well, try not to do that.
Yeah. I mean, if they can make it to the point where they're like 20-10 after this stretch, I mean, that's phenomenal.
That'll be great. Yeah.
I mean, you can't ask for much more than that from the early going. Cause I remember thinking that, early on with a few series against the Twins, the Rose might be able to pick up some wins, but with a lot of games against the White Sox, Indians and Tigers, I mean, a month ago, the Royals were supposed to finish fourth behind all those teams. So the idea that they were going to play so many in the first month, man, it could have been a rocky start. And I was thinking 500 was probably a good bet to, you know, good baselines that they could build off of that moving forward and have hopefully one of their big second half swings. But this hot start, and I kind of mentioned it, Dan Zimborski kind of hit on it in one of his tweets I saw a few weeks ago, that the Royals have picked that just that 7-0 start. The Royals have put themselves so far ahead in terms, you know, statistically speaking, that, you know, it's hard to overestimate how important that was to be in a good start. Cause yeah, like you mentioned, assuming they can hold on and win tonight, they'll be 6-6 after the 7-0 start, but that still puts them at 13-6.
Yep,
which is pretty damn good. Even though I haven't checked. What's the Tigers' record? I haven't checked recently.
They're 13-6 starting.
Are they as well? Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're hanging with them right here. This is going to be a big series this coming weekend.
And the Tigers start off really, really hot too. I mean, they were winning, like the Royals would win, the Tigers would win, the Royals, you know. So, you know, they're not going to be that hot all year. The Royals obviously won't all year either, but still going to be one of those things. Mike Moustakas just got his fourth hit of the game. I think
is he really fixed? Is he really fixed, Mike? When are you a believer? When are you buying?
I don't know. I was thinking about this earlier, and I looked back at 2012, which is probably his best offensive year, which is kind of saying something. On June 24th,
like 245 that year or something.
Yeah, on June 24th, Moustakas, his batting average was .280. He had a .347 on base percentage and was slugging .492. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
He finished
the year. Didn't he have like 15 home runs at midseason too?
Like
not midseason 10
or
like
something.
Star break.
Yeah. But he finished the season hitting .242 with a .296 on base percentage, slugging .412. So, I mean, it's great to see what he's doing. And he's driving the ball better. Like last time we were talking, okay, a lot of these are just, you know, bloops. He's been driving the ball better. He's been doing, you know, the pop outs haven't been there. He's not striking out as much. So those are obviously positives, but at the same time, it's like, you know, anybody can have a really good month. And so far he's having a really good month. If he has another good month and then another good month, then you kind of think, okay, maybe there's something to this approach where he's actually doing something differently that's getting results. You know, an actual adjustment that is paying off. And I mean, short term right now, yeah, it definitely is. He's got, you know, more hits to the opposite field almost now in 1 month than he had all of last year. And that's significant, but I do need to see it more, before I start to believe, just because, you know, he can go into those deep funks too. And that's one of those things that can just crush a season. So, you know, I don't know. All-star break, if he's still doing some of this at the all-star break, he'll probably, one, be an all-star.
Yeah.
And two, you know, it'll look a lot more real.
Yeah, you know, it'll be I don't even know if I could buy in this year. It might be one of those things. Like, I wasn't buying in fully to Alex Gordon after 2011.
Yeah.
Either when he had his first kind of breakout year. So, I mean, I just by nature, I lean towards the more conservative. I'm an accountant by trade and all that. So conservatism is something that's kind of in my blood. But I will be infinitely closer to buying in if, like you said, after the all-star break, he's still knocking the ball around really well and he's basically an all-star. And I mean, Yeah, I'd be a lot closer.
It's and yeah, then, I mean, it, and it's tough. It's just, it's like you said, the example of Gordon. It's like, okay, well, he had a good year, but then you kind of want to see him prove it the next year. I mean, you feel better when he's up there, so that's something. It's not like in the past where it's like, well, here's Moose, yeah, and then you just kind of don't expect anything.
Here comes a pop up.
Yep, yep, and he, you know. He was doing a lot of those, and they haven't been as frequent in the last like week and a half. So that's comforting, because a lot of that is just either he's late or he's, you know, rushing himself. And, you know, if he's not doing, you know, if neither of those things are problems at the moment, then, yeah, he's going to make a lot better contact. So that's encouraging. And Eric Hosmer just got a hit too. So Hosmer's walking a lot. He's got 12 walks already. He only had 35 last year.
And we talked about this. We both kind of remarked that his plate approach really kind of seemed to change in October. Like Moose, we could kind of tell, was more or less just getting lucky and turning on a few pitches in October, because his stats didn't really bear out any legit improvement. But Hosmer was a little bit of a different story, and he looked like a different player.
He wasn't chasing the crap that he usually chases. He's not doing that now.
No, and he's carried that over, and that's what I mean. You went at like 2013 and most of 2014, really, it was okay. Hosmer comes up. I mean, you could see it. We talked about it on the show. The catcher would do his little waddle and would move towards the outer half of the plate because everybody knew the book on Hosmer. Everybody knew how to pitch to him. Yep. Throw that kind of sweeping sinker, curveball type, you know, whatever, and just let it kind of tail away, and he's going to flail at it. And he's done an incredible job of really being able to identify that pitch and being able to lay off it. You know, I never thought, just judging by how his approach went and how he would swing at those, I didn't know that he would ever be able to get past that. And so far he has. I mean, I want to see him, you know, continue it for the whole season. But, man, he's really – his approach has really matured, and it's paying off dividends because he's walked a lot more. He's getting better hits, better contact, and he looks, you know, just both him and Moose look like they've matured a little bit, and they look like, and I'm not talking, you know, I'm talking as a baseball player, but and they both look like a little bit more like the players we thought they were going to be.
Yep. I mean, you still want more power. I mean, I was thinking about this as I was driving home, because when I was driving home, Vargas was facing Carlos Santana in the first. And I thought, okay, well, the Tigers have Cabrera, the White Sox have Abreu, and the Indians have Santana. But the Royals don't – they still don't have that guy. And Hosmer's kind of who you would put in that role, but he's still not that guy that – I don't think teams are really scared that he's going to – you know, crank a three-run homer on you. I think you're afraid that he's going to drive in one with an opposite field single. And I think you'll take that from a cleanup hitter, you know, in that situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, that's what he did to drive in Moose today, was he just hit it the other way. But at the same time, it's like, if he's getting on base and he's making good contact, you know, that's going to be something of value. I'd still like to see more home runs and some more power from him, but
yeah,
you know, I mean, if it's just never going to come, I guess it's just never going to come. And if that's the case, well, he'll just have to be a doubles guy who walks, and I guess you deal with it.
Yeah, you know, there are worse things. If he can just, and I think without being, you know, having total knowledge and being a scout or anything, I think there's kind of an evolution of if you're Hosmer and someone who's had his struggles but has that natural power, you know, if you do have to refine your approach, which he definitely had to, then there's that kind of plateau intermediary period, I think, where you have to look at it and he says, well, I'm gonna give up some of the power now to establish my approach and my baseline, but then as it comes and I get more hits and the pitchers start having to, you know, give me better pitches, then it's going to come.
Yeah.
And he's going to be able to turn on a few, and it'll look, hopefully, my biggest hope for Hosmer is that it looks like it takes less effort from him. Because right now, it looks like it takes a lot of effort for him to hit the ball hard. He swings very violently. And that's part of, you know, who he is and why he – it's a fast swing. So it doesn't cause him to kind of lose anything. But it just – sometimes I think he has that I'm going to be a hero swing. And yeah. It just, you know, makes him look bad when he whiffs and he almost falls over the plate. And, you know, I'd still like him to eliminate that aspect of his game so that he can, you know, you look at some of the home runs George Brett hit. I mean, he's never out there swinging hard.
Nope.
You know, I mean, he had a good, quick, compact swing that when he connected right with the ball, it went a long way. I mean, he had a, you know, a season or two where he hit 30 plus home runs. So it's, you know, that's my hope for Hosmer, is that he, with this refinement of approach, he kind of learns, hey, you know, if I just take it easy and don't try and be the hero, I can go out there and the power will come.
Yeah. Guys like Jose Bautista and Carlos Santana, who end up walking a lot. I mean, the other part of that is that they have a lot of power. And so if they're getting better with their approach and their discipline, they're going to have, you know, pitchers are going to have to come in and give in to them now and then. And if you get them a hittable pitch, I mean, they can hit a long way. I mean, you just look at Hosmer when he hits a homer, he usually gets a good amount of it. And so, I, you know, hopefully that's kind of the evolution that, okay, pitchers learn that, okay, we have to give him a little something extra than that sweeping curve to try to get him out. And, you know, either they're trying something different or they're trying to get more of the plate so that it has a shot of being called, or maybe he'll swing at it, you know. And then if they miss that pitch, then, you know, that's the one that he can tee off on. And if that's how it works out, that'll be great. But right now, I mean, that's at least encouraging that he's willing to take a walk and he's able to make those judgments to not swing at, you know, the junk that he would always swing at. So if that continues, I think that bodes well for him, you know, this year and long term. You know, if he's kind of wisening up to some of those things that he knows he doesn't need to swing at that pitch that's going to end up in the dirt in the other batter's box, you know, that's going to be a good thing.
Yeah, can't complain about that. So, well, with that, I think we've kind of hit on the most pertinent points from the past week or so.
Pretty much.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any. I mean, they haven't really made any moves or anything. And
no, they've shuffled some minor league guys up to just kind of fill in. You know,
Bubba Starling got promoted, didn't he?
Bubba Starling got double A. Tonight was his debut in Northwest Arkansas. Hit really, really well in Wilmington to start out, and I mean, he was still striking out when he was putting the ball in play. It was, you know, he was driving it. So
yeah,
that's very encouraging. Jorge Bonifacio.
Wilmington's a tough park.
It's a tough park, and it'll be interesting to see what he does in a much more friendly hitter's park.
Yeah. And
but it's also against tougher competition. So,
yeah,
you know, it might trade off. But if he gets it figured out.
I'm far, far from a believer after just a few good weeks in Bubba Starling. But if I'll allow myself a moment, I mean, could you imagine an outfield with Gordon Kane and then put Bubba Starling in there? Like, because, I mean, he's got major league caliber defense already from what I hear.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got speed that can rival Kane's. So the amount of ground that they would cover, I mean,
it's basically if you ridiculous. Did like a heat map of what they would cover, it's basically it's all covered, like nothing falls in. The only way to keep from hitting it out is to put it in the seats. And as we saw yesterday with Gordon, that's not even a guarantee.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's encouraging. Jorge Bonifacio is hitting for power now. Brett Eibner got hurt. That's a bummer.
He was primed to kind of break out this year.
He was doing something. Yeah.
Hopefully he'll, I haven't heard the full details on that. What's the, with him, his injury?
There's something with his leg. I don't recall the injury or what the time frame is. I mean, it wasn't like serious, but it was like, you know, enough to take him out, and he's had enough injury problems over the years that it's like, okay, well, that sucks. So I don't know.
Well, hopefully he can get back on track. And good to hear Jorge Bonifacio. And, you know, it's not entirely unexpected either, because I think it was 2013, Bonifacio was ready to break out, and everyone was calling for him to be a breakout prospect. Broke his hamate bone, I think it was.
Yeah, which is
bad.
Hand injury is not good for a hitter. Yeah.
A lot worse than what Rios has.
Yeah.
But so in those, it takes almost a full year to really get that power and the grip back and feel comfortable at the plate. So it's not altogether surprising that he's doing a little bit better this year than he was last year. And hopefully he can get back onto that track that he was in 2013. Cause then if you can get Ebner healthy and get him ready, and then if Starling keeps progressing, and then you've got Bonifacio, Starling, and Ebner all kind of ready to fill in that open spot in right field over the next year or two, if they can all kind of be competing, that's a good thing. That puts the Royals in a really good position.
And you got Paulo Orlando, who's been doing fine so far with Rios out. He's hitting triples all over the place.
Triples. And the Royals have one.
They have one.
So they're 13-6.
Yeah.
Which, man, I'm loving it.
That was a pretty good win.
This team.
You get Corey Kluber against Jason Vargas, and Vargas only goes five, and you win. That's solid.
When you're playing against the Cy Young pitcher, against a team that many many favored to win the division, then you're going to be okay. After coming off two straight losses, you know, take that any day of the week.
Yeah.
So hopefully they can get another one, win this series, and move on to Detroit.
Yeah.
This weekend.
Go get Detroit.
Hopefully. Yep. So with that, I think we'll end this show. Do not forget. We'll be here to remind you. But Kelly's in Westport, of course, our lovely sponsors, having their annual block party on May 24th. That's a Sunday. Memorial Day is the next day. You can party all night long. You don't have to worry about going to work the next day. So be sure to make some plans. Put it on the calendar. Mark it down. Write a post-it. Tattoo it on your arm, whatever you want to do. Make sure you know and get out there, because it's going to be a lot of fun. I would be there if I wasn't going to be out of town. But anyway, Mike, you had something else you wanted to...
Yeah, another event coming up, and they're not really any kind of an official sponsor, but it's just a fun event that I think people should go to, is Dressed to the Nines Day, which is going to be May 17th. It's
kind of sponsored by the Negro League Baseball Museum.
Yep, it is. It's part of the official Royals promotional.
Bob Kendrick, friend of the show, so go, you know, help support.
Yeah. I mean, go to the museum. I mean, just it's like $8. I mean, seriously, just go to the museum.
Completely and utterly worth.
It's just great. I mean, you see something new every time, and they're getting new exhibits, and they're doing new events and everything. So, museum's doing really, really well right now. I had an idea to try to, like, sit down with Bob and some of the people who helped start Dress of the Nines, but I don't think the time's going to work out to make it work. But that's going to be May 17th. It's a game against the Yankees. It's going to be the Salute to the Negro Leagues Day. And, you know, I think you've seen it over the last couple of years. You can show up in, you know, kind of your Sunday best. That's the idea, is that, you know, people go to church and then immediately go to the ball game. So wouldn't have opportunity to change clothes. So ladies would be in dresses and men would be in suits and things like that. And it's kind of a neat little twist, you know, and since it's the Royals and it's Kansas City, there's always kind of like a neat retro feel to the city and a lot of things. So it's cool. They've got a promotional ticket that you can get, and some of the proceeds will go to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. They're doing a brunch thing too, and there's going to be other events in Kansas City. We'll try to see if we can track some of those guys down. Obviously, our schedule of recording has been sporadic at best, so it may be difficult. But
if we can track down Bob Kendrick, I'll make sure to be available.
Right, that's pretty much what you do. If he gives you the time, you sit down and listen, and just—I don't even care if I've heard the same stories 10 times. I'll listen to him again, because they're good stories, and he's great at telling them. And you know, so I mean, he'll be all in the middle of that.
Yeah. So with that, we'll end this show. it's been a good one. Lots to talk about. Hopefully, we'll have more talk about. Hopefully, less off the field, more on the field. More Royals winning.
Right.
Hopefully, they can keep this momentum, and we'll be talking about a three-game sweep of the Tigers next Monday, possibly. Let's keep our fingers crossed on that one. So this has been the Kansas City Royals Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Thanks for stopping by. I am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me, of course, has been the great and wonderful and powerful Michael Engel. So
don't look behind the curtain.
Don't look behind the curtain, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for stopping in. And as always, go Royals.